Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First package in today's list is KCodex, which at the end of the previous episode I said was probably about video codecs and maybe audio codecs and how exciting that was, and maybe I would be able to speak about video codecs because that's something that I, well, used to deal with quite a lot less so now. But anyway, this has nothing to do with video codecs. KCodex has nothing to do with audio encoding or video encoding. It has everything to do with character encoding. Surprise, surprise. I legitimately didn't know that at the end of the previous episode. That's why I was talking about all the other things. I just assumed that it was the kinds of codecs that I used to deal with. And that's not really the case, which is fine. This is just as interesting, I'm sure, although I know considerably less about it. What I will say, just in case you don't know, codec is a tech term. And it's the combination of two words, code and decode, or maybe encode and decode, I'm not sure. But those two terms, those ideas, are smashed together into a quick and easy one phrase, codec. This is KCodec, so we can surmise correctly that it's codecs that are designed by the KDE, the KDE framework. And of course, that is exactly what it is. So KCodex is this package, and it contains mostly header files, to be honest, a couple of CMake things, a couple of Python utilities for the whatever it's called now, the KDE Python project, but mostly header files, which bizarrely point to, well, so they're framework files, which then strangely point over to the header files. I'm not sure why they link them that way. So you've got, for instance, KCodex. You open up KCodex and it says include KCodex.h. There's one called KEmail address, and that you open that and it says include KEmail address.h. So I'm not sure the purpose there. It must be some subtlety of maybe the IDE or something. I'm not sure if the framework wants to do it that way. But anyway, it's mostly header files, and things like, I don't know, kemailaddress.h, if I take a look at that, open that up, it's a bunch of definitions of methods that have functions like validate an email address, and split a comma-separated list of email addresses, and splits a given address into a name and an email address and a comment, an optional comment, I think. Optional? Anyway, a comment. Now, these aren't the actual, this is just a header file. So this is naming the methods, providing the syntax, and documenting the input and output. If you want to actually see the work that gets done here, you have to look at a bunch of other files, because that's what header files do. They define information, declarations, and syntax for whatever they need to define for code files. Maybe that's something that this could be a good topic for, because I don't know that much about codecs in terms of like character conversion and things like that. I've never done that before, but I could at least explain what a header file does, because there have been a lot of header files lately. I don't know a good example, but let's try to generate one here. So let's say that I've got a file called myheaderfile.h. And in that file, I'm going to define something that a bunch of different code files might need. And that could be anything. It could be, for instance, in what we're looking at here in KCodex, it's defining methods that it gives a name and it gives a result and it tells you what the arguments are for that method and so on. So these are snippets. I mean, the actual conversion doesn't happen in the header file. It's just giving you pieces. So for instance, if I wanted to define a string that read KDE for whatever reason, So I could do hash include greater than or whatever, less than ampersand hash 60 semicolon. So whatever that character is, less than, I think, string dot h greater than, right? So angle bracket, string dot h. So we're including that in this header file. And then I'm going to define a string. So I'm going to say string x equals quote KDE close quote semicolon. And that's actually not going to work. I'm going to go back to the beginning of the line and do standard std colon colon string x equals KDE. That's the header file. Now I'm going to open a file called mycodefile.cpp. And here I'm going to do a bunch of this is going to be the actual code. So I'm going to do include iostream, include my header file dot h in quotes, so include, so hash include quote my header file dot h close quote, include string again, I'll probably need that, that'll probably be it. And then I'm going to do using namespace standard std semicolon, and then our class, or not our class, our code, our method, our function, int space main parentheses int space arg c comma char c h a r star star arg v close parentheses open curly brace. And I think I'll just do let's do a little for loop here. We'll do for parentheses int I equals 0 semicolon I less than arg c. So as long as we have an argument to look at, or a value, so something that a parameter that the user has typed in at the terminal. Then, well, first of all, increment the count, plus plus I, parentheses, curly brace. So now we're in the for loop. C out less than x, less than, no, actually, no, we'll do C out less than arg v bracket I, close bracket, so whatever the next value is, and then less than x, less than end L semicolon. We can close the curly brace there, return 0 semicolon, and close the curly brace, and now we're done. So now when we compile that, we have to do G++ dash I, capital I for include, and I'm just going to put a dot. So it's dash capital I dot, meaning that among the include files that I want my program to be aware of, or the compiler to be aware of while it's assembling this code, I want to include the current directory. And the reason I'm including the current directory, of course, is because I just put my header file .h here in this current directory. So the compiler needs to know where to find that include. Now, iostream and string, it already knows where to look for those. So doesn't matter. If it did matter, I could also include that. I could define that as an include, but it doesn't matter. Those are the default. That's the default include path. The thing that I'm compiling, of course, is mycodefile.cpp. It compiles, and now I can do .a.out, which is the default output name of what we just compiled. So a.out. And I'll type in the word or the string, hello. And then I get, oh, I forgot about spaces. But anyway, I get one big long string that says, hello, KDE, all one string. How did it know to append, to append KDE to my hello? Can I preserve spaces if I put that in quotes? Yeah, okay. So there, I cheated. A.out, quote, hello, space, close quote. Now I have hello, KDE. So how did it know to append KDE? Well, it knew that because in my header file, which then got compiled into the code, the string X was set to KDE. So that's what header files are. You might wonder why they exist, and the answer is that usually they contain a lot more than one random string. There's, you know, look at KCodec. There's a bunch of header, a bunch of information in the header file. I mean, a lot of it, frankly, is comments, but there's an enum that's defined, and there's methods and all kinds of things that are set there in that header file, meaning that when you're writing code, if you include that header file, you get a bunch of sort of standardized definitions and required parameter and syntax of those parameters, and And that way, at least in this case, you have consistency across all of your different KDE applications. So when one KDE application is referencing, you know, I don't know, is valid email address or whatever. I mean, I've closed that file now, so I don't know the exact string, but you know, the name of some output or the name of some method, they're all the same because they're all referencing the same header file, and that provides a lot of consistency and obviously a lot of compatibility, because now that method across all of KDE is the same, and it has the same requirements for the input, it has the same output that it's going to give you, and that's great. I mean, that's a really significant, I would imagine, a very significant way to organize a very, very large software project with lots of contributors. Like, how are you going to make sure that no one re-implements the thing that splits an email address into its component part? Well, this is one way that you could do that. Okay, so that's K codecs, plural, and that's K-C-O-D-E-C-S, codecs. And next one in the list is a color chooser, K-color chooser. K-color chooser is exactly what it sounds like. It is an eyedropper that you, it's a graphical application. You launch it, you get a little eyedropper, and with that little eyedropper, you can just sort of roam around your screen, find a color that you like, hover your cursor over that color, and you see the value. You can click to sort of set that value as the current value, and you have that value here in your K color chooser window. So I just clicked on sort of an orange of Audacity's logo, and I got red 255, green 121, and blue 1. Maybe I didn't need it in that format. Well, that's okay. It converts it automatically for you to HTML as well. HTML as well. So FF7901 is what that translates to. You also get it in HSV values, 28, 254, 255. So three different methods of expressing the same data right there on your screen. Oh wait, there's another expression of that, which is the actual visual expression of that color as calculated by your screen. And so you get to see sort of like that color as a big color swatch. I have to say, K-Color Chooser is, well, an implementation of K-Color Chooser, which I more often use it as a little plasmoid widget in my panel. But either way, like, that functionality is one of the things that has sold me on Linux for I don't know how long. Like, the discovery of how prolific, is that the right word, prolific? Yeah, prolific color choosers are on Linux desktops was just a revelation to me. It was such a big deal. And it still is to this day. I still find myself referencing colors on screen a lot more often than you might expect. Heck, I do it more often than I expect. But it's just such a convenient way to get to match colors, really. I mean, it's just, it is a great way to do that. Now, it's important to know that if you are, say, designing something that has brand guidelines, it's important to know that the color that you're seeing follows the brand guideline. Because, I mean, that's the absolute response. And this, of course, is within your screen, as it were. In other words, that color to you, to your human eyes, seeing that color on a monitor that anybody could have set up, that might not look like the quote-unquote right color, the correct color to you. Under certain lighting, it might look different. At a certain brightness of your monitor, it might look different. So getting what the computer sees that color as is really, really important, because you cannot trust your eyes. It's just, you can't do it. So this is a really important method of confirming that the color swatches or the color settings that you are using match some other baseline color setting. It doesn't do anything sort of for alignment of your monitor. That's not what this is about. It's just, if you download an image from somewhere and it's using a color blue that to you looks a little bright, and you know that it's supposed to be kind of dark and rich, well, break out K-Color Chooser, get a sample of that, and see what the computer sees it as. Because the computer is sending the bits that it is sending. Your monitor is interpreting it or displaying it one way or the other, and your eyeball is seeing it, and your brain is processing that depending on a bunch of different factors. But you just need to know, what are the settings? What are the color? What is this color supposed to be? What is this color supposed to be set to? What is it sending? What kind of data is contained in this color? That's what I was trying to say. So it's hugely useful, K Color Chooser, and I use it, as I say, more often than one might think. It is one of those go-to applications for me. So K Color Chooser, it's a hugely big deal for me. The minute I'm on a Linux desktop that I'm not familiar with, if I can't locate very promptly the color chooser application, then I install one immediately. And I also consider, you know, I think about my choice there. Like, is this the right distribution for me? Because it doesn't have a color chooser readily available. So yeah, it's a big deal. And there are lots of different ones. You know, you don't have to run KDE Plasma Desktop to have a color chooser. There are lots of different color choosers out there. Stuart, I know of him from Lug Radio way back when that was still a thing. He's got a color chooser that he wrote, which is quite nice. So they're out there. You just have to maybe possibly look for them. Okay, next up is K Completion. This is, guess what? A bunch of header files. Yeah, this is a bunch of header files to help with completion of like file names and things like that. So I don't know if you remember me raving about Dolphin, the file manager Dolphin, but I do love Dolphin. And one of the really nice features of Dolphin is that in certain configurations, and I think you have to activate this, I don't think this is the default, could be misremembering. In certain configurations, if you have a breadcrumb trail or a location bar in Dolphin, which I think by default it's just a location bar that tells you where you are, but you can go into configure Dolphin, there it is. Configure Dolphin, you can go in there somewhere and tell it to use an user editable, you know, allow the user to edit the location bar. I cannot find where that is now. Maybe that's the default now. Maybe that's not something that you have to configure anymore, because I'm not seeing that option. But it could just as easily be an option that I'm just, my eyes are sort of just skipping over. Yeah, I don't see it. So maybe that is. Anyway, so you can just type in like /home/Klaatu/ let's go to my, downloads folder. And so if I start typing capital D, it already starts, it auto detects the possible completions for that based on the things that I have in my folder. So the Dex, demo, desktop, documents, downloads. So actually I'm going to go into Dex instead of downloads, because I'd rather look at Magic the Gathering deck files than a bunch of random downloads. So here's a bunch of files that I have in this folder, and if I wanted to open it with an application, an other application, because by default it wants to open it in Emacs, then I could go to the choose application and want, oh no, actually that doesn't do it. Okay, well I guess that's where that ends then. Okay. I thought the open with other applications had that same functionality. Either way, the point is that when you start going into an editable field in many KDE applications, it has the ability to sort of auto-complete what you're typing. And it's not auto-completion based on like just an arbitrary dictionary. It is based on specific things. So these header files provide the different implementations of that. So there's completion, there's history, things to look at the history, there's sortable listing, there's K-line edit. I assume that's what you're doing when you're entering into the field, I'm not sure. Combo box stuff, completion box. Yeah, there's a bunch of different ones. Completion matches. It's a hugely useful little, not library, but collection of include files, of header files. And we've just talked about what header files are, so we know what that is. And that's kcompletion. Next up is kconfig. Kconfig provides an advanced configuration system. It's made up of two different parts, kconfig core and kconfig GUI. Kconfig core provides access to the configuration files themselves. Kconfig GUI provides a way to hook widgets to the configuration so that they are automatically initialized from the configuration and automatically propagate their changes to their respective configuration files. There you go. So let's look at this kconfig package here. Kconfig, is it a bunch of header files? Yes, it is. It's a bunch of header files and a couple of things for Python, it looks like. Oh, and there's a library in there. There's a library, shared object. And yeah, I mean, I just read what it claims it is, and I'm going to believe that that is what it is. So kconfiguration, persistent application settings. I mean, that's always important. On a related note, there the next package is kconfig widgets, which is, let's look here, header files again. And this is essentially, it's providing the easy-to-use classes to create configuration dialogues, as well as a set of widgets which uses kconfig to store their settings. Configuration is really important, and it can be a tricky thing because it's one of those, at least I find, and this doesn't mean a whole lot because I don't do this all day, but I find that when sitting down to define a configuration, you do kind of have to, you find yourself peering into the future a lot more than is comfortable because you don't know the future. You don't know exactly what your application is going to need to remember in for a configuration. That can be difficult to figure out, like, the best format for your configuration. Kconfig helps you figure that out just by sort of, I mean, the KDE framework knows itself pretty well. And so having the ability to sort of know all of the different things that you are going to probably have to track for a KDE application, I imagine would be very useful. And I say that very much assuming that that's the case because I've never written a KDE application. I've never written an application that hooks into KDE in any way. All right, next up, kContacts. This is part of the KDE framework, so you guessed it, it's a bunch of header files, and this is stuff for address book functions, addresses, address list, calendar URL, client, PID map, contact group, email, field group, gender, geo, IMPP key, lang, nickname, note, so all of these things, phone number, you know, these are all entities that you can use throughout different applications like kAddressBook, kMail, kOrganizer, kPilot, and so on. kCore add-ons. kCore add-ons provides classes built on top of Qt Core to perform various tasks, such as manipulating MIME types, auto-saving files, creating backup files, generating random sequences, performing text manipulation, and so on. So these are kCore add-ons. In other words, it's not add-ons for KDE, it's add-ons for Qt Core. And Qt Core is the C++, or part of the C++ framework, really, that KDE itself is based on. So KDE, in a way, I hope I don't say anything too controversial here, KDE, in a way, has always been an extension of Qt. And so you've got a lot of Qt stuff that honestly a lot of Qt programmers are very, very familiar with. I have had the pleasure of being both at conferences and at workplaces where there were large groups of Qt programmers. Like, that's what they were. They were programmers who knew C++ and Qt. Like, that was their specialty. And so they know those libraries. And KDE takes those libraries and then staples a bunch of other stuff on top of it. And as long as you're including Qt and KDE, then you have a KDE application. So kCore add-ons are add-ons to the core of Qt, which is kind of a a big deal because it does have a lot of the basic, really, really basic data types that you're using very often when you're building, you know, when you're assembling like your window. A lot of that stuff comes from Qt Core, or at least it did when I was playing around with it. Kcrash. Kcrash provides support for intercepting and handling application crashes. Crashes are, they're a necessary part of life. They happen. Things crash. Frankly, I have had mixed experiences with crashes. Obviously, there are lots of different types of crashes. Sometimes it's a little quirk, a little glitch. Sometimes it's something that freezes the application window. Sometimes it closes the application window suddenly out from under you. Sometimes it closes it and ends the process. Sometimes it closes it and leaves a zombie process on accident. Sometimes it crashes your whole desktop. Sometimes it crashes your whole kernel. You know, all kinds of crashes, right? And that can be, they're never great. They're never fun. So Kcrash is a thing that ideally mitigates what you have to go through when a crash occurs. We've already talked about Dr. Conkey a little bit. Kcrash is just, it's a header file, so it's got stuff to try to, again, deal with, like, sort of intercepting and handling application crashes. Obviously, crashes are difficult to plan for as a developer. It is difficult, you know, you can plan for, like, exceptions in your code, you can plan for unexpected things to happen or unexpected output or input to be received, but an actual crash where we're off the rails, we're outside the off the track, then it's really hard to predict. And if you can predict it, then you could probably plan to make sure that it didn't crash. So I don't know. I very much respect developers who write things like Kcrash and Dr. Conkey and other things like that really do try to sort of soften the experience around a crash, because it's not something that anyone wants to experience, and it is something that happens, and sort of the eternal question is how do we make it better? Sometimes the only way to make it better is to make it reportable, or to intercept it and to capture the output right before the crash or right after the crash or whatever. So there are ways to try to mitigate it, try to make it a little bit, try to at least make it useful, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Okay, almost time for a coffee break, but let's do one more. Now one more is Kcron. Kcron's a little bit of a tricky one. When I first came across the entry in var log packages, you kind of look through it, and it says Kcron is a module for scheduling programs to run in the background. It is a graphical user interface to Cron, the Unix system scheduler. So that seems pretty straightforward. It's a graphical user interface for Kcron. So go to the application menu, type in Kcron. Nowhere to be found. Doesn't exist. Okay, well, maybe it's more like, I don't know, maybe something's wrong with K application menu and it's just not finding it. So how about if I just type in Kcron in my terminal? No, there's no such command. Which Kcron? Nope, doesn't exist. Okay, so you go to the var log listing, and where did I put it? There it is. Kcron, and scroll through, and there's documentation. There are some there's a library. There's a share. Some locales. No binaries, no user bin, nothing like that. So, all right, let's look at this, the library thing here. Where was that? There it is. In user lib64, libexec, kauth, kcron helper, that's not useful, lib64, qt5, plugins, kcm_cron.so. Now, you remember KCM, if you'll recall, those are the KDE config manager or something, or modules or something like that. And I don't remember how far we got down that path, because I think there was another thing that I was going to talk about. But anyway, KCM, as it turns out, it's kind of like modular sets of applications that kind of, let's say, get embedded in other applications. And long story short is that Kcron is a KCM module, or a KC module, or a Kconfig module, whatever they're called. And it's the location that you would find it, it's not an application on its own. It is tucked away in the system settings application. So if you go to K application, launch settings or system settings, whatever you prefer, and then that launches. And I think by default, I don't know what, what's the default view of that thing these days? I don't know. I've already clicked away from it. Now I don't remember what it was. Here, I'm relaunching it. So by default, oh, I guess it's just wherever you, I didn't click. It was just wherever you left off. Okay. So left-hand column, bunch of different listings of potential settings. There's a search field. So let's look for KCron. KCron, no, doesn't come up. There's no KCron here, but there is a KCron here. Why can't we find this stupid thing? Well, if you do a lot of searching on the internet, you'll discover that obviously KCron is a KCM module or whatever, embedded in system settings, startup and shutdown, task scheduler. And I've just gotten a warning here. It says, welcome to the task scheduler. No mention of KCron. You can use this application to schedule programs to run in the background, schedule a new task. Now, click on the tasks folder, select edit new from the menu. Okay, so that's KCron. It's the task scheduler in system settings in startup and shutdown, and then you can go into task scheduler and schedule arbitrary events. I'm not going to do that right now. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. You can do personal cron or system cron, which I think is quite nice. I don't know whether or not that really belongs in system settings. System settings, personal cron. I don't know if that matches up for me personally, but I think it is nice that this kind of respects the fact that users do have access to cron, so they can set their own sort of things here. I don't know if I was admining a computer and I was handing someone this computer, I don't know that they could look at this and tell the difference between modules within system settings for which they need some kind of administrative privilege versus things that they're allowed to play with and change for themselves. I think there's definitely a little bit of a gap there between things you're not allowed to do in system settings versus what things you are allowed. It's not just a KDE problem. I think it's a very widespread operating system problem. People don't seem to design the OS, even multi-user OSs, for multi-users, or rather for an admin-user split. And I think that's cognitively, I think that's difficult. I think it's difficult to open up an application that's managing the settings of your computer and not really understand whether you're going to be able to click into something and you're going to be prompted for some admin password that you have no way of knowing, or you know, you have no sort of right to know according to your admin, versus what you can and should and are welcome to change, like your desktop background, or which network maybe is your active network. Maybe that's not something you can control. Your configuration of your mouse. Yeah, you're probably allowed to do that, and so on. So I think that's problematic. Like I say, it's not a KDE problem. It's an OS problem. I think there could be better definitions or just better separation around what you're going to need a password for. What's safe to experiment with, I guess, is really what I'm asking. Although I think there, you know, maybe there's an argument that maybe the other side of that coin is, well, if we show them everything, then they'll have to click around on everything to discover which they have access to. And maybe that's a good thing, because otherwise maybe they wouldn't think to click on adding a printer. And surprise, surprise, they can add a printer because they've been granted that permission. Whereas changing their network, no, they're not allowed to do that, because we want to make sure that they're only on this approved network or whatever. I'm just making up scenarios now. Anyway, that's the KC section of the KDE packages. We're done that. KCron was the last one. Next is KD, KDAV, KDEV, K this, K that, D. So we will do that. We'll start that, I don't know, next episode or something. Let's go grab a coffee together. We'll come back. I want to talk a little bit about Magia, because I haven't talked about Magia in a while. I'm going to talk about Magia. Let's go get coffee. Welcome back. Is that coffee that you have? Why, I'm sure it is. I'm glad that you've gotten yourself some coffee. I've gotten myself some. And we should talk about Magia, because I haven't talked about that in a while. I have said fairly recently, I don't know, within the last year or so, that on my personal laptop, my work laptop, which is also my personal laptop. I don't have a laptop. I have my work laptop. On that machine, I run RHEL, Red Hat Enterprise Linux. As of a couple of weeks ago, 9.0. And I've said on this show that RHEL is a functional operating system for personal use now. You can install RHEL. You'll get absolutely nothing you need in the repositories. I mean, well, not absolutely. You'll get like LibreOffice, things like that. But you won't, you know, very sort of office-centric types of things. Maybe some developer stuff if you activate a certain repository within their, you know, base OS, app stream, supplemental. You enable one of those, and I think there's the other one, code-ready workspaces. You enable one of those repositories. You can install some extra applications that you didn't see initially. But generally, it's very server-focused. And then, you know, also sort of as a consolation prize, you also get some office-y types of applications. Not really what I'm into. So Flatpak has changed the way that I use RHEL, and, well, it changes the fact that I can use RHEL, and so I install a lot of applications as Flatpaks on RHEL, and I enjoy the same kind of stability that I enjoy on Slackware, which I run on my desktop here that I'm recording on, of course. And you know, it's on my laptop. It's my work laptop. It's running RHEL. It's got Flatpak applications. Everything I need. I mean, everything from, I don't know, you know, like text editors, IDEs. Although actually the IDE that I use, I just installed a /opt. So that kind of doesn't even count. Firefox, I installed a /opt as well. There's a bunch of stuff, I guess, that I installed a /opt. But anyway, Flatpak does provide me with a bunch of other things that I do use, like video editors and media players and other stuff. I don't even know what I have installed in this thing. But anyway, you know, the things that I do on computers, I can do on this laptop, and it works quite well, and it is on RHEL. And that's different for me, because in the past, if you'd asked me what I used, I would have said, oh, I'm a Slackware user, and I usually have a computer running Fedora as well. That would have been what I would have said. And lately that just hasn't been. And that's, I mean, I'm talking like up until, you know, I don't know, a couple of years ago, that's what I would have said, honestly. But lately Fedora, I've just had to come to terms with the fact that it just moves too fast for me. I am not at a place in my life where I want unexpected behavior out of my computers. And there was a time in my life when the fast pace of Fedora was exciting. And it was almost like, why wouldn't you want that? Like, if you sat down at a computer and everything worked, what do you do on your computer? Like, what's left to do? And nowadays, I do stuff on my computer, and I want it to work. That's my primary interest. And I think there is a weird, subtle difference between thinking to yourself, oh, I use Linux versus I use a computer. Because once you've run Linux long enough that you sort of, you no longer think about, oh, I use Linux, then what you're left with is, I use a computer. And there's no significance to the fact that that computer runs Linux. It's just, that's your computer. It happens to run Linux, but I mean, that's your computer. And so I think at the when you stop thinking about, oh, I use Linux, and you're just using a computer, then I think possibly what you are looking for is the computer part of Linux. You're looking for the part that you turn it on and it does all of the things that you want the computer to do. That's what you're looking for. And that's where I am. I don't use Linux. I do use Linux. I don't use Linux. I use my computers. They happen to be running Slackware and RHEL in this case. And as I said before the coffee break, Magia. Now, I'm not using Magia on a daily basis, to be honest. It's a project that I like to check in with. When Mandriva ended, tragically. I mean, tragically, because Mandriva was really great, and it was a pity to lose Mandriva. But when it ended, Magia forked that project and announced that they were going to continue it. Now, there is another fork of that project called Open Mandriva. I do try to check in with Open Mandriva every now and again, but I have to admit that my brain, it's got Magia pretty much lodged into it since since then, really. And so I go to Magia before I even remember Open Mandriva exists. And it's not saying anything about Open Mandriva. It's just saying Magia is the thing that I have in my head when I think of what's up with Mandriva these days. I think Magia. Okay, so there's Magia. And Magia is a very nice little distribution. Of course, I've gone on record saying that I think Linux has too many distributions and that we need to scale back, not because distributions, you know, that choice is not good. I like choice. I just think that the distribution model is broken. So I would much rather, for instance, Magia just be a set of repositories and some custom apps that you could install on the generic Linux base that, you know, doesn't really exist right now. But anyway, there's, you know, the delivery mechanism is what it is, right? I mean, it's a fantasy world to say we're going to just have a base Linux thing that you install, and then you get to choose the custom, you know, the customize your experience packages, and these customize your experience packages are what we now call distributions. That doesn't exist. So the distribution model is you go to a website, you download the image, the ISO image or the .img image, you put that onto an SD card, your USB stick rather, you boot your computer and you install the OS. So that's how we do it. So that's how you get Magia. No surprise there. You go to Magia, you download the distribution, you install it on a computer. And I've done that on a spare computer that I have in a wardrobe that runs, you know, whatever kind of server stuff that I want it to run. But I also have a keyboard and mouse over there. So every now and again, I go back there into the wardrobe. And I open the wardrobe, and then there's a shelf. And on the shelf is this computer and a monitor and a keyboard and a mouse. And I've got Magia on that computer right now. And so I've been messing around with Magia quite a bit. And once again, I'm just reminded of how great a little distribution it is. And, you know, I mean, there was a time where a distribution was essentially a different desktop or the same desktop, but configured a little bit differently. Instead of the panel being at the bottom, it's at the top. Instead of it being at the top, it's on the bottom. Or instead of going to system settings, you go to control center, something like that. And when you're new to Linux, I mean, that is kind of what a distribution is. So saying that, oh, Magia is a great little distribution, what does that mean? Like, what, you like the theme? Well, I do actually like the theme. I like the branding. I like the cauldron with little bubbles out of it. I think that's very clever. Because Mandriva used to call their next, the thing that was next was the cauldron. It was always, that was, you know, Fedora uses Rawhide, Debian uses Cid, I think. And then Mandriva uses Cauldron, or used Cauldron. So Magia took the Cauldron branding and ran with it, and I think it's quite clever. But the big deal about Magia for me is the difference between Fedora and RHEL, where RHEL has essentially nothing in its repositories, and Fedora has essentially everything in its repositories, except it doesn't really, because it has what it can have. But then it's got RPM Fusion, so there's software there. So you end up finding everything for Fedora. And again, not everything, but you find a lot of stuff for Fedora. So there's a lot of stuff for Fedora, very little for RHEL, and Magia sits square in the middle of those two extremes. Magia has a very rich repository, lots of stuff available, not everything, but a lot of stuff. So in terms of it just sort of being like your standard middle-of-the-road Linux distribution, which doesn't sound very exciting, that sounds kind of almost like a backhanded compliment, but it's actually just an upfront compliment. It is a compliment. Like, if you want a distribution that has a reasonable amount of software ready for you to use from its little software center store, Magia is one of those distributions. It has got a lot of great software for you, already packaged, ready to go. You can install it through its little text-heavy application store. So in other words, it's not using the pretty pictures that AppStream.xml or whatever it is provides, things like GNOME Store, GNOME Software or KDE Discover. It's a lot more like Synaptic in feel. You know, it's just like a bunch of text, But it works. It's functional. It does the job, which is a little bit more than you can say of GNOME software, you know, about 25% of the time. GNOME software is great, but it takes a lot of setup to get it into the great state where you can actually use it. And even then, sometimes it gets a little bit confused. So I think there's work to be done on GNOME software yet. And I think that the Mandriva, the Magia choice to just continue using its little Drake thing, whatever it's called, is perfectly acceptable. Dragora? No. Anyway, whatever it's called, I think it's great that it uses it. And yeah, it's not super pretty, but it is highly, highly functional, which is what you want. Now, there are extra repositories for Magia as well, so you can find more software if you enable more software repositories. But I just think as a baseline, like, expectation, that there's a lot there. And you can add Flatpak onto Magia as well, so you could do that too. You can have the benefit of a well-populated repository along with the well-populated FlatHub offering for a bunch of the applications. I am not doing that on my Magia install because it really is serving primarily as just a little home test server right now. It's a very old computer. I rescued it out of a trash can. Not literally, someone gave it to me instead of putting it in the trash can. I have literally rescued things out of trash cans before, but this was not one of them. So it is a very old computer, which, by the way, is another nice feature of Magia. They do 32-bit. Fedora, I think, has officially dropped or is talking about it dropping 32-bit support. So the fact that Magia is just ardently continuing 32-bit support is vital. I mean vital. It is one of those services that I just think almost a moral service. It is morally important for Linux to have 32-bit support. There are way too many computers out there that are 32-bit capable only. And Linux has to be there for those computers. Magia is a very nice option for that. You might have to install a lightweight desktop, and Magia makes that easy as well. They have GNOME, they have KDE, and they have XFCE. And I'm running XFCE. That's actually why I installed Magia, because I eventually, in this Slackware, as I go through all the packages, eventually I'm going to hit the XFCE desktop, and I have very little experience with it. But as of, you know, a couple of weeks ago, whenever I installed this thing, I'm gaining experience with XFCE, and I don't want to get ahead of myself because we're not talking about XFCE yet, but it is really, really nice. I'm finally seeing what other people see in XFCE. Really nice. So Magia, it's there. It has software. It has 32-bit support. It's got a really great little control center. I love control center from Mandriva, and I love it in Magia. It's just one of those things that it's got all of the things that you would expect it to have are there. Now, it does not solve the problem that I identified earlier with system settings and control panels in general, where users don't really know what they have permission to do in that control center. It's just a gamble as to whether you're going to click on something to configure it and it's going to ask you for an admin password, or whether it's going to let you do the thing. It doesn't really solve that problem, but it is a really nice control center, which I have a lot of fond memories from Mandriva about, and it's just so great to see it being continued here in Magia. Magia uses DNF now, not URPM. That makes me a little sad, like quote-unquote sad, not really sad, but nostalgically, like it's sad to see URPM go away. But of course, you can just alias URPMI for DNF install, URPMQ, DNF search, and so on. So not that big of a deal. It's actually quite nice to have DNF. DNF is a very capable package manager. To me, it's zipper level great, and zipper is, or was when I last tried it, really, really great from OpenSUSE. So it's quite nice. So Magia, I feel like the pace of its release cycle is perfect. I think that its repositories are very reasonable, and I think that it's a really, really well-assembled distribution. I'm highly recommending it. I really am. You know, and I'm not recommending it, say, over Slackware. I'm not recommending it even over RHEL or over Fedora. I'm just saying that it is a reasonable option. It's one of those, like, especially if you are looking for a good RPM distribution, an RPM-based distribution, Magia is, I think, a stellar option. I mean, you really only have RHEL, Fedora, Magia slash OpenMandriva, whichever you go with, or OpenSUSE. I mean, those are your options. And all of those are strong. Like, that's the thing. maybe that's what I'm trying to say about distributions. Like, those are really strong distributions. While if you were to say, well, I want to go with a .deb-based distribution, then yes, you have lots and lots and lots and lots of choices, but the quality of those choices varies quite a bit. But the RPM-based distributions, it seems that, like, it's kind of filtered its way down to a certain select few, but they're really strong select few. They're like, really good offering of distributions. So Magia is one of those. It's middle of the road. It's got a nice deliver. It's got a good pace. It's not going to release a new version every other year. It's a really nice pace of release. It's got solid repositories for all the software that you absolutely need, a lot of the software that you just want, and then you've got obviously options outside of that. So if you're looking for something like Fedora or RHEL, but you don't want to use either of those, or like CentOS, RHEL, whatever, you don't want to use those, try Magia. It's a good one. I think that's all I have to say. That's probably it for this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.